Okay, welcome. My name is Divine. I'm a resident. This is episode 163, I believe, of the Divine Intervention Podcast. And this podcast, I'm going to title this USMLE Step 2 CK Rapid Review. I will go ahead and call this Series 19, I think. And it's going to be focused on surgery. Because, again, I've gotten a lot of requests for that over the last couple of weeks. And this one is going to be focused very specifically on the abdomen. Because, again, right, abdomen is very high yield. I mean, it probably constitutes, like, I don't know, like 15-20% of the surgery shelf. So I will just try and, you know, very rapidly go through some high yield abdominal concepts. Now, first thing I guess I want to go ahead and mention, right? What if they give you a question about a person that sustains a penetrating trauma to the abdomen? What's always your first step? Well, exploratory laparotomy, right? You don't, like, think twice. You just take the person straight for X-lap. What if a person has, like, blunt trauma to the abdomen? What is your next step? The thing is, typically, you have to kind of skip a few steps because they'll give you more information in the question. But in general, when you see, like, a blunt abdominal trauma question, right, the first thing is they'll usually tell you the person has, like, rebound or guarding. The person has rebound or guarding, right? They obviously have signs of peritonitis. Under those circumstances, your next step will be to, you know, proceed to X-lap, right? Once you see signs of peritonitis, you don't have to think twice. You go for X-lap. If the person doesn't have rebound or guarding, then you just kind of have to ask yourself, is this person stable or is this person unstable, right? If the patient is stable, then you can do like a CT scan of the abdomen. It'll give you a lot of information. You may even be able to stop there because it'll just give you a ton more information than the other stuff. But if the patient is unstable, right, then you want to consider going with a fast scan on your test. If a fast scan is not available, you can do something called like a diagnostic peritoneal lavage. Although, again, essentially no one does that in the real world. But if a person is unstable and they have blunt abdominal trauma, and they have no signs of peritonitis, you can consider doing a fast scan. If fast scan is not there, then you can choose the DPL. Another thing is, if the fast scan is equivocal, right, then you want to consider getting a diagnostic peritoneal lavage as well, right? And again, if that fast scan or DPL or whatever is positive, right, let's say you see blood or whatever, right, then you need to go ahead and proceed with surgery. So that's just something, again, high yield. That's a very high yield algorithm to keep in mind. It's just one of those things, you know, it's going to show up on your test. Okay. Now, what if they give you a question about a patient that recently underwent like a cardiac catheterization for like an RC infarct, and then they tell you that hours later, this patient starts complaining of back pain, and this patient is like kind of like hypotensive, kind of unstable. What's your diagnosis there? Well, I hope you're thinking about like a retroperitoneal hemorrhage, right? Retroperitoneal, like hematoma or retroperitoneal hemorrhage. Under those circumstances, you absolutely want to, you know, perform angiography with embolization. That'll be the right next step in management on your test. Now, what if they give you a question about a patient that, you know, was in a pretty bad like motor vehicle accident? And then this patient, they tell you that the urine output has been like very minimal over the last couple of hours. And then they tell you that this patient on physical exam, he has like a suprapubic tenderness to palpation. Or suprapubic fullness. That's another word they'd love to use on exams. What kind of diagnosis should you be considering? Well, I would hope you're thinking about like urinary retention, right? Like this person essentially may have like a cauda equina syndrome. Although remember that one other thing that could present this one NBMEs is a person that has like metastatic cancer. So it can be like a guy with a history of prostate cancer that has, again, suprapubic fullness, or a lady that has a history of breast cancer and suprapubic fullness. Obviously, if the person is having like, you know, signs and symptoms of like a spinal cord compression, then the first thing you'd want to do under those circumstances is to give IV dexamethasone. But if all the problem a person has is like urinary retention, then your next step is actually to perform a bladder catheterization. That's one thing that shows up, you know, quite commonly on exams and you want to keep in mind. Now, the thing is, one, I guess let me just go ahead and mention this. What if you get a question about a patient and they tell you that this patient has ruptured the bladder, right? And they tell you that, oh, the person has ruptured like the neck of the bladder or the trigone of the bladder. What's your diagnosis? What would you want to do next as like your management step? Well, you can actually treat this conservatively, right? So remember, for purposes of step 2 CK, you want to know how to differentiate between a person that has ruptured the bladder, like an intraperitoneal bladder rupture, or a person that has had like an extraperitoneal bladder rupture, right? So the intraperitoneal kind in general, that tends to be at, like, for the dome of the bladder, right? And those people tend to have like just like diffuse pain, signs of peritonitis. They feel pretty crappy, right? And in general, for that, you just take them straight to surgery, call your friendly urologist. But the extraperitoneal one is more along like the bladder neck or like the blood, like the trigone of the bladder. For the most part, again, like I said, you can treat non-operatively. You don't need to do anything fancy. In fact, sometimes you can just insert a Foley catheter, you know, keep it in for a couple of days and the patient gets better. And usually, right, these people don't have like the diffuse severe abdominal pain and rebound and guarding and all that stuff. And then what if they give you an exam question and they talk about a patient that, you know, was recently like in an accident, like a motor vehicle accident, and this patient is complaining of like left shoulder pain. What diagnosis are you thinking about? Well, I hope you're thinking about like a rupture of the spleen, right? Remember, right, there's something called a curse sign. It's like a person having like shoulder pain whenever you have like some issue that's irritating the diaphragm, like a ruptured spleen or like a subphrenic abscess, right? So the thing is, when people have like a ruptured spleens, right, that can irritate the diaphragm on the left and that can cause a referred pain to the shoulder, right? That's known as curse sign, K-E-H-R, not like Steve Kerr, as in the Golden State Warriors coach, but Kerr sign, K-E-H-R. So they'll have like referred pain to the shoulder. So those are, in fact, really like if a person has like, you know, like blunt abdominal trauma to the abdomen, they very likely have a splenic rupture. If they give you like a very non-specific question without much in the way of clues or hints, think about a rupture of the spleen. Remember the spleen, right? Again, it's the most commonly ruptured organ when a person has like blunt injury to the abdomen. And really, there are many things that can cause splenic rupture, right? Like abdominal trauma. If a person even has chest trauma that involves like the lower ribs, that can also puncture the spleen. And remember, right, if a person has splenic issues, you know, you want to try to see if you can treat it non-operatively. But again, if the person, you know, by some unfortunate stroke of events, you have to remove the person's spleen, don't forget to vaccinate that person against like Shin organisms, right? So like strep pneumo, H flu, and Neisseria meningitidis. That's a classic thing that your friends or the USMLE are love to test. And then, right, if I'm just sort of walking through the abdomen, if you're looking at the liver, right, the liver is like the second most commonly like injured organ in a person that has a blunt abdominal trauma, right? And again, they can have like right shoulder pain. If you think above the liver, right, the diaphragm, right, the diaphragm can rupture, right, and that can also be like a sequelae of a blunt abdominal trauma. Although typically, right, on imaging, they'll show you like abdominal contents in the thoracic cavity. When you see that, think about a diaphragmatic rupture. And hopefully, right, you know that that typically happens on the left, right, not on the right, because the liver kind of protects things on the right side, right? But there's really nothing protecting the diaphragm on the left side. So most times when people have a blunt abdominal trauma and they have a rupture of the diaphragm, that almost always happens in the setting of like usually happens on the left. And I guess since I'm talking about the diaphragm now, if they describe a person that, you know, recently had some kind of abdominal surgery, and then this person is complaining of like, this person has been having like fevers, and this person has been having like abdominal pain, and it's been going on for like days and days and days. Under those circumstances, you really do want to think about something called a subphrenic abscess. Okay, that's a pretty classic presentation on MBME exams. And then remember that if a person has a diaphragmatic hernia, right? So if they describe again a newborn and they show you imaging and you see like abdominal contents or you see like abdominal folds in the thoracic cavity, under those circumstances, I would really, really hope that you're thinking about a diaphragmatic hernia. And remember that they occasionally test the buzzword embryologic pathophysiology behind the diaphragmatic hernia, right? It arises from a failure of a formation of the pleuroperitoneal membrane, right? And again, you may say, Divine, oh, that's so much. How do I remember that again? Pleuroperitoneal. I love embryology. Embryology just makes sense, right? Pleuroperitoneal membrane is a membrane that separates the pleural cavity and the peritoneal cavity. Okay, so that's a nice way to keep that straight in your mind. And then let's see. Let me look at other abdominal organs in my mind. Let's say like the pancreas, right? Like a person can get like again in the setting of injury, right? If a person has like a motor vehicle accident where they like lurch forward and hit the abdomen. Or they can give this in like a child that has epigastric pain from like a bicycle, like handlebar injury. Under those circumstances, think about injury to the pancreas. Those people will classically have like elevations in lipase. Remember, lipase elevations are more sensitive than amylase elevations for the diagnosis of a pancreatitis. And then, since I'm also talking about handlebars, right? If they describe a kid, you know, that has had like a handlebar injury, and this kid is kind of like having like drops in his hemoglobin, complaining of like epigastric pain, sometimes it can be back pain, and they may tell you that, oh, on abdominal exam they see a pulsatile mass. Under those circumstances, sometimes they may even put like bilious vomiting. Again, it will be like an acute issue. Under those circumstances, you really do want to think about some kind of duodenal hematoma, right? That's a classic presentation of duodenal hematomas on MBM exams. Another way a duodenal hematoma may present on a test is they can give you a question about like a person that was recently started on like warfarin, right? For some kind of, I don't know, like coagulopathy. So you start them on warfarin and then they start complaining of like epigastric pain, their hemoglobin is dropping. Under those circumstances, you also want to really think about a duodenal hematoma. And then if a person, say for example, right, has like a peptic ulcer disease, and then they tell you that the person becomes like suddenly becomes profoundly hypotensive, losing a ton of blood, or you know, maybe they won't say losing a ton of blood, but they will show you like a hemoglobin that has gotten acutely low, the patient is profoundly hypotensive, complaining of like severe abdominal pain. Under those circumstances, I would really want you again to think about like a perforation of a peptic ulcer, right? And if they ask you for the blood vessel that is likely bleeding, the one I really want you to pick on your exam is the gastroduodenal artery, okay? Go ahead and pick the gastroduodenal artery. They love to test that stuff all the time on MBM exams. And actually, I've seen that in the real world. I've actually seen that clinically. You may say, oh, the GDA, it's nothing too bad. Why should I worry about this? I promise you, if a person has a GDA bleed, you better call your GI doctor pronto, right? That thing is rapidly fatal if it's not treated. The GDA can bleed. Like, I never used to respect the GDA until I saw it clinically. So it's just one of those things you don't want to mess around with. So this is just, I guess, pro tip for like if you're like an intern or a resident. If you suspect that a person has like peptic ulcer disease and then they kind of like start crumping or start having like GI bleed style symptoms, call your gastroenterologist. Let them go ahead and perform an EGD, right? So that they can intervene quickly. If you see like a big bleed, obviously you can also send the patient to surgery. It's just badness. It's just one of those things you don't wanna mess around with. You can get into trouble. A patient can get into trouble pretty quickly with that. And I mean, generally, right, for these like massive GI bleeds, you know, your first step in management almost always is fluid resuscitation, right? And then you want to give them like a ton of blood, right? So for your first step in management, really you do really want to give IV fluids, right? So you give a ton of IV fluids, give a lot of fluid resuscitation, and then you can consider like giving like blood products if the patient is not responding to the IV fluid repletion. And then obviously you want to go ahead and consider surgery under those circumstances. And if a person, right, presents with like right lower quadrant pain and all that stuff, right, what are you thinking about? That's obviously right, appendicitis. And then they may ask you for like your next step in management, right, on MBME exams. The thing is, your next step in management kind of depends on the particulars of the question, right? So let's sort of talk through that real quick, right? So if, for example, they give you a question about a patient, you know, appendicitis, they have like the classic right lower quadrant pain, and all, you know, all those physical exam signs you're looking for, like a Rofsen sign or SOAS sign or whatever. It's like all there, acute onset, right lower quadrant pain, fevers, leukocytosis. Like the story is like, you know, pretty classic for acute appendicitis. And they ask for your next best step in management. Really, you want to consider just jumping to an exploratory laparotomy under those circumstances. Although you can also do like a laparoscopic appendectomy, right? So that's one thing you can do under those circumstances. But let me actually warn you of something that they may use to, you know, like maybe like try to trick you on the exam. They can try to trick you by giving you a question about a patient that, you know, like it's been like, you know, a couple of days. So like 7, 8, 9 days, they've been having like, you know, like fairly, like gradually worsening, right? Lower quadrant pain. They've been having fevers. They have a leukocytosis. Yes, you want to think about appendicitis, but one other thing I would strongly encourage you to think about is like a psoas abscess. That's a classic presentation of psoas abscesses on MBME exams. They will try to, you know, really try hard to trick you that it's appendicitis, but it may be a psoas abscess. So you may say, okay, divine, how do I know the difference between these two? Well, here's a trick you can use on your test. One trick you can use is if a person has acute appendicitis, I mean, look at the name, acute appendicitis. Your symptoms tend to show up acutely, right? You tend to have acute symptoms. But if a person has like a psoas abscess, their symptoms tend to like brew and get like progressively worse over a couple of days, right? That's one nice way to differentiate that on your test. That is also one of the reasons why if a person presents with acute appendicitis, especially if they are stable, right? You know, you want to go ahead, especially if they're stable and they're like an adult, you want to consider getting like a CT scan of the abdomen, right? You get a CT scan of the abdomen with contrast. When you do that, that can help you delineate like many different appendiceal pathologies, because depending on the appendiceal pathology, that tells you what you're supposed to do, right? So if, for example, again, you say like, you know, like the regular good old appendicitis, then under those circumstances, right, you go ahead and perform like an appendectomy. Usually everyone does like a laparoscopic appendectomy, although you can also do an open appendectomy. And typically, right, you want to give antibiotics as well, right? You want to give like a ton of antibiotics, especially like an antibiotic that covers like GI flora, right? So like you can give like Cipro plus metronidazole, or you can give like a first generation cephalosporin, like the surgically beloved ANSEF. I feel like every surgeon, they love ANSEF. They have like this ANSEF fetish, but basically, right, cefazolin, right, is ANSEF. So you give cefazolin, and then you give metronidazole, because the metronidazole will help you cover anaerobes. Now, they give you a question, right, and they tell you that, oh, you see, like, you know, this person has, like, you know, classic signs of appendicitis, and then you notice that the appendix has perforated on imaging, right? Then under those circumstances, you want to, you know, proceed to, like, very quick, very rapid appendectomy because it's fairly life-threatening, right? So that's one big thing you want to keep at the back of your mind. And then one thing is if you see, like, an abscess in the appendix, right? So if a person has, like, an appendiceal abscess, they may try to trick you to do, like, an immediate appendectomy. That's the wrong thing to do on exams. The right thing to do on an exam, if a person has an appendiceal abscess, is to actually go ahead and give antibiotics, right? Drain the abscess under like some kind of imaging guidance. And then weeks afterwards, you can then go ahead and perform an appendectomy, okay? That's very high yield to know. In general, doing an appendectomy like acutely in the setting of an appendiceal abscess is not a great idea on MBME exams. I'll go ahead and tell you that that's something very, very high yield to know for the purposes of tests. And then, again, remember your different signs with appendicitis, right? So like there's like psoas sign, there's like Rofsen sign, there's like obturator sign, right? So obturator sign, you internally rotate the lower extremity to present like writs and pain and all that stuff. Remember like your McBurney's point, all those signs, I already defined them pretty clearly in the mainstream surgery review video. So I'm going to go ahead and move on from that so that I don't burn too much time on that. And remember, if they ask you for the pathophysiology behind appendicitis, you want to think about a person, you know, potentially having like a fecalith, right? That's obstructing the appendiceal lumen, and then you have like stasis or badness behind that, and then you get into trouble with an infection. Sometimes people can also have like like just something that sort of sets them off, like an inflammatory process that kind of like sets things off, and then you have inflammation around the appendix, right? Although if they give you a question about a female, right, that complains of like right lower quadrant pain, very high fevers, strong leukocytosis, And then they tell you that the beta HCG is positive on your exam, I would strongly encourage you to, you know, consider like a ruptured ectopic pregnancy as your diagnosis, right? That's a ruptured ectopic until proven otherwise. So you want to be careful with that on exams. And then if they give you a question, right, about a patient that, you know, has like a history of, like, let's say they tell you, oh, this patient like recently had an MI, or this patient recently had a, like, they tell you that, oh, on exam, like on auscultation of the chest, or you're obtaining an EKG, you notice that a person has like an irregular interval. That's, you know, that's pretty classic for like acute mesenteric ischemia, right? Classically, it's like the superior mesenteric artery that's all screwed up. When you see that, you want to go ahead and get like some kind of angiography. And if the person has if the person is beginning to have like bowel ischemia, then you may need to, you know, go ahead and resect some sections of bowel. Remember, acute mesenteric ischemia is acute, right? Chronic mesenteric ischemia is chronic. So those people have like weight loss. They will have like very like, you know, like long-standing symptoms. They will tell you that whenever they eat, it hurts a ton. And typically, when it usually hurts a ton, like in the left upper quadrant, because if you remember from, I don't know, from like anatomy or whatever, people tend to have like the left upper quadrant, like the splenic flexure, it tends to be like a watershed area, right? So if a person has like systemic hypotension, then those people tend to get like problems in the left upper quadrant, because it's kind of like at the like the distal end of perfusion from the inferior mesenteric artery and also the superior mesenteric artery, right? So that's a big thing you want to keep at the back of your mind. And then if they give you a question about a patient that has like a long history of like ulcerative colitis, and then they tell you that over the last, 2 days, this patient has been complaining of like severe abdominal pain. His abdomen is like severely distended on physical exam. The patient has like rebound or guardian. And then they show you on imaging and you see that the transverse colon is like massively dilated. Under those circumstances, you want to think about a toxic megacolon. Your next step in management is going to be exploratory laparotomy, right? You want to decompress that bowel because that person can die relatively quickly. Two other things that can cause that toxic megacolon on MBME exams. It can be a person that has C. diff. Remember, toxic megacolon can be like a very nasty, nasty complication of C. diff. And then if they describe a person from like a developing country, you know, complain of like severe abdominal pain, and again, having like massive distension of the abdomen, like a toxic megacolon style picture, think about Trypanosoma cruzii as the potentially inciting cause under those circumstances. And then if they give you a question like about a female, you know, presents with like severe lower abdominal pain, vaginal discharge, bilateral adnexal tenderness, right? You want to go ahead and think about like pelvic inflammatory disease, right? Under those circumstances, typically, right, you go ahead and give like broad spectrum IV antibiotic therapy. And typically the bugs you want to cover are like Neisseria gonorrhea and chlamydia, right? So you want to give things like ceftriaxone and azithromycin, or ceftriaxone plus doxycycline, right? So those are big things you want to keep at the back of your mind. You may say, Divine, why are you talking about pelvic PID, pelvic inflammatory disease, in a surgery podcast? Do you think some OB-GYN pathologies show up on the test? Well, I hope you're saying yes to that. The thing is, the surgery shelf, the people that write it are really ingenious, to be honest with you, because, I mean, like, there's OB-GYN on the surgery shelf. There is dermatology on the surgery shelf. There is ophthalmology on the surgery shelf. There is pediatrics on the surgery shelf. There's internal medicine on the surgery shelf. Really, to be honest with you, I find the surgery shelf to probably be a little more challenging to prepare for compared to like the internal medicine shelf, for example. At least that was certainly the case for me during my third year of med school. And then if a person has like, PID, and then they tell you that, oh, this person starts complaining of like right upper quadrant pain, then under those circumstances, you obviously want to think about Fitzhugh Curtis syndrome, where they've had like an extension of the infection to the hepatic capsule, right? That's a classic thing, again, that tends to show up on exams. And then one other high yield thing, I guess maybe I should mention, I kind of skipped that when I was talking about appendicitis. Remember I said that if a person has appendicitis, right, and, you know, they have like, they have like the classic findings, you don't need to do any imaging, you can just take them straight to surgery. But if a patient has like, if the MBM is trying to get you to pick an imaging test, kind of look at the population you're dealing with, right? Obviously, if it's a child or it's a pregnant female, getting a CAT scan of the abdomen with contrast maybe may not be the smartest idea in the world. So under those circumstances, you want to go ahead and get like an ultrasound of the abdomen, right? In those populations. But for pretty much everyone else, you can get a CT scan of the abdomen with IV contrast. And then what if they give you a question about a patient that, is coming into the hospital, and this patient, is like stable, but they have like abdominal pain, and you plan to get like a CT scan of the abdomen with a contrast, and then they ask for the next, and this person is like a diabetic, and they ask for like the next best step in management. One of the, if there's an answer that involves, stopping the use of metformin, you probably want to go ahead and do that, because remember, right, metformin can cause a lactic acidosis in people that have like chronic kidney disease, or people that have like acute kidney injury, or in people that are getting like anything that can injure the kidney, right? So if, for example, a person is like profoundly hypotensive and they have like a pre-renal AKI, or a person is getting like contrast for some kind of abdominal procedure, for some kind of abdominal complaint, you want to go ahead and discontinue metformin in those populations. That can cause like severe problems in those patients, right? So you don't want to, because lactic acidosis is actually deadly, right? So you want to try to avoid that if you can. And then what if they give you a question about like a smoker? This person has smoked for like a long time, and then this person is presenting on like severe like mid-abdominal pain, or they can present like severe back pain, and then this patient is like profoundly hypotensive, and then they may tell you, although they rarely do this these days, I mean everyone has memorized this crap, so they don't do that anymore, but occasionally you can say that, oh, the person has like a pulsatile mass on abdominal exam. If you see that, right, you really want to think about a AAA, right? So an abdominal aortic aneurysm that has ruptured. Sometimes one other thing they can give you is they can tell you that, oh, they notice like calcifications anterior to the vertebral bodies. Whenever you see that, that's something known as the draped aorta sign. That's classic for like either a ruptured or an impending, like a soon to rupture AAA, right? And obviously, right, if a person, if you suspect a bad AAA, you want to go ahead and take the person to surgery, because that thing is rapidly fatal. I mean, the mortality, if I'm not mistaken, is like more than 50%, even when you do everything right. So you want to take that person to surgery as quickly as possible. I mean, if they are trying to get you to do some kind of diagnostic testing on the MBME, then one thing you can consider getting for those people is you can get like an abdominal ultrasound. You can use that, find the AAA and then go ahead and fix it. And in terms of fixes, right, for a AAA, you can consider getting like, you can do like open surgical repair, or you can do like endovascular aneurysm or repair like an EVAR. The thing is, both of them have pretty equal outcomes. But again, remember, I think I may have said this in a podcast I made a while ago, but this is something that your friends at the MBME are beginning to test quite a bit. Like complications of like AAA repair, right? There are three big ones you want to keep at the back of your mind. They love to show up a lot on exams. One is an aortoenteric fistula. So it can be a person that, has like a microcytic anemia like weeks to months after like a AAA repair. Then you want to consider that maybe this person has formed the fistula between the aorta and some part of the GI tract, right? So they are like slowly leaching blood into the GI tract. That can cause like, it can be like a microcytic anemia that kind of looks like, oh, this person has colon cancer. But the thing that they will try to trick you, right? Obviously, they will give you colon cancer as an answer choice there. Don't pick colon cancer. The thing is, you want to, that's why, again, I tell people that you cannot just memorize a random crap for the USMLE exam. So it's not a good strategy for success, right? Because the thing is, if you see microcytic anemia in a person that is past the age of 50, right? The first thing you should be thinking about on an MBME is colon cancer, right? So, oh, let's go ahead and get a colonoscopy or whatever. But that will not be the smart thing to do here. But if they give you context, right, it's the context that ultimately matters on any USMLE exam. If they give you the context of like recent history of like a ruptured AAA, or like AAA surgery, or like AAA endovascular repair, then, and the person has like a microcytic anemia, they give you that context, don't pick colon cancer, even if that's an answer they're presenting to you. Pick an aortoenteric fistula, right? That's a more likely answer choice on, more likely correct answer choice on your exams. So that's the first complication. Second complication is, if a person has like, actually I'll go ahead and talk about four complications. One other one that just dropped in my mind. If a person has an aortoenteric, AAA repair, right? One thing that, and then they describe that the person is like paraplegic or has like urinary retention after surgery. You want to think about like, ischemia of the spinal cord. Typically, it arises from like problems with the artery of Adamkiewicz, which is a branch of the abdominal aorta. So if you see paraplegia, like urinary retention, or like chronic Aquinas-style symptoms after like a AAA repair, think about like an infarction of the artery of Adamkiewicz. They will typically say something in the question about like multiple episodes of like profound hypotension during the surgery. If you see that, think about artery of Adamkiewicz involvement. I remember the artery of Adamkiewicz tends to supply the anterior 2/3 of the spinal cord. So again, a AAA repair can be integrated on an MBME exam with anterior spinal artery syndrome. So that's a big thing you want to keep at the back of your mind. And then a third complication you want to keep abreast of is if they describe like a patient with like rising creatinine after like a AAA repair, this person has probably just had like ischemia of the kidneys during the case. That's a, again, a classic thing that shows up on exams. And then one sneaky one that I'm almost certain is not in most resources that people study is this thing called an endoleak. Right, so they'll describe a person, you know, that has a history of like a AAA repair, and then they may tell you that this person, you know, has been having like the hemoglobin has been like slowly dropping. Person has like microcytic anemia style symptoms, and usually for this kind of question, they may not give you an aortoenteric fistula as an answer choice, but they may tell you that, oh, like on angiography or like CT scan of the abdomen, they notice that when you give like contrast, you are seeing contrast go beyond like the margins of the excluded aneurysm. If you see those, you really want to think about an endoleak. There are many different types of endoleak. There's like type 1 to type 5, but I'm fairly certain that is beyond the scope of it's not a matter of being fairly certain. You know what, you can never say 100% for anything. I'm like 99.9% sure that is beyond the scope of the step 2 CK exam, so I'm gonna go ahead and skip that. There's like a type 1, type 2, type 3, type 4, type 5 endoleak, but I think that's a little too much, so I'm gonna go ahead and skip that. I'm not gonna talk about that right now. And obviously, right, for AAA, you want to remember the biggest risk factor, right? The biggest risk factor for AAA is smoking, right? And remember the screening guidelines, right? If a person is more than 65, if it's a man, not women, if it's a man, right? In general, women are not screened for AAA. I have no idea why that's the case. I mean, some women are screened, but those are like some super specialized guidelines that, again, I will be shocked if you saw your step 2 CK exam. But in general, women are not screened for AAA. Still boggles my mind to this day. But in general, for men, if you've smoked and you're more than the age of 65, you do deserve like a one-time abdominal ultrasound. And the cutoff number you want to remember, right, is 5.5 centimeters. If you find your AAA is more than 5.5 centimeters, you go ahead and fix the AAA. Or another thing is, if a person has a AAA and it's grown by like 0.5 centimeter in 6 months or like 1 centimeter in a year, then under those circumstances, again, you want to go ahead and fix that. Or if a person has like a AAA that is symptomatic, you also want to go ahead and fix that surgically. Although one other thing you want to keep in mind is, if a person is above the age of 50 and you have a family history of a AAA, those people also deserve like the one-time abdominal ultrasound for AAA screening. That's like a sneaky one they can throw on your exam, although that's probably a little more common on step 3. Like a person has like, you know, they're like more than 50 years old and they have like a family history of a AAA, even if they've not smoked, those people deserve a one-time abdominal ultrasound to screen for a AAA. And then if they describe a question about, if they give a question about like a young female, right, and she has like sudden onset severe abdominal pain while she's like studying for an exam, and then they tell you that, oh, like weeks earlier they found like a cyst in an ovarian ultrasound, yada yada yada, then you want to think about ovarian torsion, right? You want to think about ovarian torsion. You want to go ahead and, you know, fix that surgically, like detours the ovaries so that they don't get ischemia of the ovaries. The ovaries cannot survive for more than a few hours without adequate blood supply. Usually, right, the big risk factor for like ovarian torsion is having like something that like bulks up the ovary, right? So like having a history of like PCOS, for example, or having a history of like a dermoid cyst, right? Like a teratoma, or having a history of like like some kind of ovarian cyst. Those all increase a person's risk for ovarian torsion. And then again, they can try to trick you on an exam by putting like, oh, like ovarian torsion as an answer choice, or they can say like a rupture of like an ovarian cyst as an answer choice. The thing is, before you ever pick rupture of an ovarian cyst as an answer choice, you want to make sure that they say something about like free fluid somewhere in the peritoneum in the question. If you see free fluid in the peritoneum, well, the free fluid just doesn't just show up from nowhere. It doesn't just appear out of the blue. Something must have ruptured to cause that, right? So under those circumstances, you know, you go ahead and proceed to surgery, because those people have like signs and symptoms of peritonitis. And then if they give you a question about a patient, you know, that has had like this bulging abdominal mass for like the longest time ever, and then they then tell you that, oh, this person, this mass in the person's abdomen is no longer reducible, and the patient is complaining of like severe abdominal pain and all that badness, that's a strangulated hernia. You want to go ahead and fix that surgically, because again, that can cause a bowel ischemia like really, really fast, right? And you don't want to mess with that. And then if a person, you know, comes in complaining of like right upper quadrant pain, and they may even have like shoulder pain, and they have fevers and leukocytosis, obviously that's acute cholecystitis, right? Under those circumstances, you want to go ahead and get the right upper quadrant ultrasound. You'll find classically on imaging, right? You'll find like, you know, like thickening of the gallbladder wall. You may find like pericholecystic fluid. If you see that, you want to go ahead and proceed to a laparoscopic cholecystectomy, and you give the patient like you know, pretty adequate amounts of antibiotics. And then if, for example, the right upper quadrant ultrasound is equivocal, right, the next thing you want to consider is getting a HIDA scan, right? The HIDA scan, it's a nuclear medicine study. It's actually a beautiful physiologic study, but I'll probably defer that to another discussion. A HIDA scan is like soup. If the HIDA scan is negative, you don't have a basically if you don't see filling of the gallbladder, right, then the person has acute cholecystitis. But if you notice that the gallbladder fills in the process of getting a HIDA scan, and the person does not have acute cholecystitis, you've essentially ruled out acute cholecystitis under those circumstances. And if, for example, right, a person has like cholecystitis, and they tell you that you don't see an obstructing stone, that is something called acalculus cholecystitis. They'll try to trick you on an MBMA exam by asking for the next step in management. They'll give you an answer choice that says like laparoscopic cholecystectomy. Don't pick that answer choice. You'll get it wrong. The way you treat acalculus cholecystitis is by doing something called percutaneous cholecystostomy, right? Because these patients are usually like super sick, right? Like they're like ICU patients, patients on TPN, patients that are on ventilators, right? Acalculus cholecystitis, like cholecystectomy, like right now, is never the right answer, right? You can do it later, but really, for the most part, what you do right now is a percutaneous cholecystostomy. And then one other thing they could do on an MBME exam is they can give you a question about a person that has So one weird thing they may give you on exams, they may give you a question about a patient, you know, that, you know, has like kind of like signs and symptoms of like acute cholecystitis. This one, they almost have to tell you the answer in the question, although people tend to still get this one wrong. It shows up rarely on exams, but when it shows up, most people get it wrong. But basically, right, they can describe a person that, you know, has like signs and symptoms of acute cholecystitis. They go ahead and show you like, well, this person will have like almost like cholecystitis plus, right? Because usually if a person has acute cholecystitis, they typically just have like, you know, like right upper quadrant pain, they have fevers, they have the leukocytosis and all that crap. But if they give you like a person that has like cholecystitis plus, where they have all those like, you know, classic cholecystitis symptoms, but then the person kind of looks like one way they may put it is the person kind of looks like a person that has ascending cholangitis, right? So they'll show you like right upper quadrant pain, but the person have like fevers, you have like profound jaundice, but then they will tell you that, oh, like on when you get imaging, the common bowel duct is not distended. You're like, that's weird, right? If you see that, think about something called Meritzi syndrome. Typically, when they are describing the imaging findings, they may tell you that, oh, this person has like, they will tell you that, oh, an obstructing stone is seen in the cystic duct, but you notice that the common hepatic duct is dilated. Whenever you see that, again, you really want to think about Meritzi syndrome. Essentially, the thing that happens is these people have an obstructing stone in the cystic duct, so that bulges the cystic duct. As the cystic duct bulges, it then compresses the common hepatic duct, right? And then when you compress the common hepatic duct, you have like a conjugated hyperbilirubinemia, and you have like profound jaundice, right? So that's a Meritzi syndrome. One complication that can actually happen with Meritzi syndrome is you may actually notice that the person has something called a cholecystocholidocal fistula. I think I'm saying it right, but I think that's right, like a cholecystocholidocal fistula. It's one of those things. Basically, it's a connection between like the cystic duct and the common hepatic duct, like a fistula that forms. If you see that, again, think about Meritzi syndrome. Classically on exams, you can make the diagnosis of a right upper quadrant ultrasound, but to be honest, probably something that's probably a lot better in terms of diagnostic utility is an MRCP. So that's something you want to keep at the back of your mind. And then if a person has You know, like your right upper quadrant pain, fever, jaundice, and then let's say they're profoundly hypotensive, crazy high white count, you want to think about ascending cholangitis, right? If they ask for your next best step in management, they'll try to trick you to get a right upper quadrant ultrasound on your test. Don't do that. The thing you want to do on your exam is to go ahead and get an ERCP. An ERCP is diagnostic and therapeutic, right? Because those people, they have like a stone obstructing the common bowel duct, right? So this is a medical emergency, right? This is the one where you know, gring your gastroenterologist in the middle of the night, call them out of sleep and get them to the hospital to fix this problem. It's a GI problem. It's a gastroenterologist problem, but it classically shows up quite commonly on surgery and MA exams. So that's something, again, you want to keep at the back of your mind. And then if a person has like cholelithiasis, right? They typically will not have fevers, right? But they will have like right upper quadrant pain, and they will tell you that the person has like dilation of the common bowel duct. So they won't have like the very sick picture that you see with ascending cholangitis. Typically, again, for that, you can make the diagnosis by doing a right upper quadrant ultrasound. If that's equivocal, you can proceed to an MRCP. That's pretty helpful under those circumstances. And then, if a person has like blunt trauma to the abdomen, right, and the trauma involves the kidney, they will try really hard to try to get you to do a nephrectomy on an MBM exam. Don't do a nephrectomy on an MBM exam. In general, if the kidney is messed up, you want to try to use like non-operative management. That's typically a smart thing to do. You don't want to go ahead and like bring out a person's kidney, because in general, when you rip out people's kidneys, it tends to have like, you know, pretty bad morbidity and mortality. Even when people get like a kidney transplants, this is actually something high yield to know, so pay attention here. When people get kidney transplants, they tend to keep the new kidney in like the, I guess, the transplanted kidney, they tend to keep it in the pelvic fossa. They don't remove the bad kidneys that are there, right? Because again, there's been a lot of studies that have shown like worsened morbidity and mortality when you take out a kidney that is like a dead kidney, essentially, right? So you just want to leave it in place. Don't mess with it. Just leave it in place as is. What if they give you a question about a patient? I didn't realize. Well, this is, I guess, 41 minutes already for supposed a rapid review podcast. But I just want to kind of be a little comprehensive with the abdomen here. What if they give you a question about a patient that, you know, has had a... So I'll try to round this up soon. Sorry. So if they give you a question about a patient, you know, that has a history of like, peritoneal dialysis, and then they tell you that this person is, you know, over the last 2 days, this person has been having like mild fevers. So it won't be a crazy fever on MBM exams, right? So this is the way this will present, like fever of like 100.7, like very mild fever, right? This person has like, you know, has been kind of acting a little crazy. Like person kind of has like altered mental status. And this person is complaining of like, you know, like low grade abdominal pain. If you see that, you really want to think about, spontaneous bacterial peritonitis. The thing is, your friends at the MBM, right, they realize that every human being has memorized SBP in the context of like, oh, alcoholic, elevated portal pressures, all that crap. And they're really trying to curb doing that these days. So one nice way they present SBP on exams these days is in the context of a person that has like peritoneal dialysis. Under those circumstances, your next step in management obviously is to, you know, do a paracentesis, and then you'll see more than the 250 neutrophils. And then really for those things, you want to go ahead and give a third generation cephalosporin like ceftriaxone, or you want to give us like cefotaxime. And then those people, right, they may require like fluoroquinolone prophylaxis afterwards to kind of like decrease the risk of recurrence. And remember that there are actually no differences in outcomes between like peritoneal dialysis and hemodialysis. And remember that if a person is about to get a peritoneal dialysis, you want to insert a dialysis catheter at least a month before you initiate a peritoneal dialysis. If a person is getting like hemodialysis, you need to insert an arteriovenous fistula at least 2 months, right, before you initiate the hemodialysis, so that the fistula can mature. You may say, Divine, what are all these weird things you're talking about? I promise you, these things are all high yield to know. They are one of these like innocuous things that you don't generally find in many resources, or people tend to gloss over, but it ends up being very high yield for exams, right? So that's something you want to keep at the back of your mind. And if they give you a question about a patient, you know, that has had like a recent AV fistula like instituted for like possible initiation of hemodialysis, and then they describe that this person has been having like, you know, like severe, like, you know, like mild chest, like, okay, let's not say severe, but like chest pain, like hypotension, the person has like crackles in the lungs,
and the person has, like, you know, like heart failure style symptoms, but they tell you that, oh, they perform an echocardiogram and the person's EFE is like 75%, like some crazy number. You want to think about high output heart failure, right? High output heart failure is pretty classic in people that that's a classic presentation in people that are getting like an AV fistula done for hemodialysis. Many people are used to like the classic, like you were stabbed somewhere and then you develop an AV fistula afterwards, like pulsatile mass in the arm and high output heart failure. But the thing is, the NBME is beginning to de-emphasize that. So think about this AV fistula process for like hemodialysis. That's a nice way to tend to present a high output heart failure on exams. And then other things you want to keep at the back of your mind, right? If a person has Paget's disease, right, that can obviously also cause high output heart failure because the person's bone marrow becomes like hypervascular. That can be a classic presentation of a high output heart failure. So I think I'm going to go ahead and stop here. I think this has kind of gone on for long, but I think, you know, I've covered a lot of like high yield stuff that sort of touches on the abdomen. Like I've talked about the pancreas. I mean, obviously, if a person has pancreatitis, right, like MPO, IV fluids, pain control, remember that a pancreatic pseudocyst can show up like weeks after, like abdominal pain, fullness of the abdomen, epigastric tenderness. Think about a pancreatic pseudocyst. In general, giving antibiotics is not smart for pancreatitis, right? And then if they tell you that a person has like, like chronic epigastric pain, like fat malabsorption, and then they show you like imaging and you see like all these white dots in the wall of the pancreas, now that's chronic pancreatitis. The biggest risk factor for chronic pancreatitis is alcoholism on exams, right? So that's something you want to keep in mind. So yes, I think I've talked about like most parts of the GI tract. Well, I guess I didn't talk about diverticulitis, right? So like left lower quadrant pain in an old person, and fevers, leukocytosis. You want to go ahead and get a CT scan of the abdomen with IV contrast. You treat it with antibiotics, and then weeks after the person has been treated, they need to get a colonoscopy. That's a high yield thing you want to keep in mind for exams. And remember that if a person, you know, has a history of diverticulitis and then they tell you that you're now noticing like poop or like air in the person's urine, the person has formed this thing called a colovesical fistula. That's a classic thing that tends to show up on the USMLE exams. And then if a person has like, you know, like severe abdominal pain and they show you like a coffee bean sign and the head of the coffee bean is oriented towards like the right upper quadrant, that person has a sigmoid volvulus. If you see like imaging and the head of the coffee bean is oriented towards like the left upper quadrant, then that person has a sickle volvulus, right? So you don't want to mix those two up on your test. And then if they give you a question about, you know, like some old guy, chronic abdominal pain, not chronic abdominal pain, but this guy is like old, has like really bad abdominal pain, and they tell you that his abdomen is like severely distended and he's not passing gas or whatever, and then they tell you that, oh, the colon is all distended and all that stuff, you want to think about a colonic pseudo obstruction. That's classically known as an Ogilvy syndrome. Your next step in management under those circumstances is you can give like a neostigmine. Remember, neostigmine is an acetylcholinesterase inhibitor, so that will raise the levels of acetylcholine and that can decompress the bowel. You can also try to like insert like a rectal tube to like literally like suck out all the air out of the colon and relieve the person's obstruction. It's called a colonic pseudo obstruction because the person has like signs and symptoms of an obstruction, but the colon is not distended. And then remember, right, if they give you a question about a person that has had like, you know, I don't know, like appendectomy in the past, or the person has had like a C-section in the past, and then this person presents with like, you know, like bilious vomiting, abdominal pain, they're not passing gas or poop, you want to think about a small bowel obstruction, right? And obviously, right, the biggest risk factor for a small bowel obstruction is adhesions from prior surgery. Well, remember, the second most common cause of a small bowel obstruction is like a hernia, and then the third most common cause is a cancer, right, which is obviously bad. So those are things you want to keep at the back of your mind. I think I've talked about most parts of the GI tract. At least those are all the ideas that seem to be falling into my mind right now. So as I do at the end of every podcast, sorry, again, I know this is a rapid review podcast. My apologies that it's long, but again, I wanted to just give you like a very good abdomen review so that you're like, oh, if you listen to this podcast, you can knock out most of the abdomen questions you get on your exam. So as I do at the end of every podcast, I do offer one-on-one tutoring for like many exams, right? So like step one, step two CK, step two CS, step three. If you're a med student, like the preclinical med school exams, 30-ish off exams, I offer tutoring for all those things. And then I do this thing called like longitudinal tutoring, where if you're like a first year, second year, third year, I'll tutor you either for like your shelf exam or like your block exams. But at the same time, I tutor you like longitudinally for your associated USMLE exam that's like coming up So if you're like a first or second year tutor for step one at the same time, again, pretty much everyone I've done this with has been like wildly successful on the USMLE exams. So if that's something you're interested in, feel free to reach out to me. I think that's something that many people have found to be extremely helpful. And then I do this booster USMLE courses for step one. It's 20 hours for step two CKN, step three, it's 10 hours each. Where again, it's something that is ideal, like if you're at the end of your prep or you feel like good with your knowledge base in general. I use a Q&A format to like integrate like multiple disciplines for you and sort of like cover most of the high yield topics you'll very likely see on your exam. Again, most people have done this. I've done this for a couple of months. Most people have done this with, they found it to be extremely helpful. So if that's something you're interested in, feel free to, again, to reach out to me. And then if you're, you know, like a resident and you need tutoring for like the internal medicine in-training exam or the internal medicine board exam or the pediatrics like in-training exam or the pediatric board exams, I do offer tutoring for all those things. And then if you're a college student and you need tutoring for like Gen Chem, O Chem, physics, biochem, histology or physiology, I offer tutoring for all those things as well. And then if you're a med student applying to residency, so like an ERAS application, or a college student applying to med school, so an AMCAS application, I do offer like one-on-one, like I guess you can call it like advising or coaching for that. So like rec letters, personal statements, mock interviews, editing applications. I have, again, I have a ton of experience with that. Most of the people I've worked with have matched at their first choice. Some are their second or third choices. But really, for the most part, pretty much everyone I've worked with has matched at their first choice. I've been on the admissions committee of a top two med school for, you know, for like a year. So I have a lot of experience reading like thousands of high quality applications. So if you need any of those things, feel free to reach out to me. Have a wonderful rest of your day. God bless you. I'll see you in the next podcast. Thank you.